Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or for next week's show, and we'll get to as many as we can. But don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about signing what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Quince and Naked Wines, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. James, our guest today is the governor of Maryland and one of the Democrats' prized political leaders, Wes Moore. Governor, you are welcome on this program anytime for any issue, but what sparked today was a picture of you walking the streets of Baltimore with the mayor. There's an impression, too widespread, fueled by Donald Trump, among others, that our cities are vast wastelands of violent crime. Trump said criminals are flooding our streets. Baltimore has been one of their major exhibits. What's the reality?
Yeah, they love talking about the horrors of Baltimore. The problem is that the realities are different than what they're talking about, which is a pretty common threat that we see from this administration. Where, you know, when I first came on board, Baltimore had gone 8 straight years of 300 plus homicides, where the homicide rate in Maryland had nearly doubled. The non-fatal shooting rate did double in the state of Maryland for the 8 years before I became the governor. And when we came on board, we said that I refuse to be a governor who just sits there and attends funerals and gives eulogies, that we are actually going to address this issue. And we started working in partnership with the mayor, started working in partnership with local law enforcement, and we made historic investments in local law enforcement. We made historic investments in predictive analytics and utilizing technology. And so you can both stop crime before it happens and also say that if someone commits a violent crime, particularly with a handgun, we are going to have them in handcuffs in 24 hours. And we also started making historic investments in community violence intervention groups and community groups and actually investing in our young people. And here is the result, that since I have been the governor, we have now seen around a 62% drop in violence, that we have now seen the homicide rate where Baltimore, now the last time the homicide rate was this low in Baltimore City, I wasn't born yet. And then Maryland has had amongst the fastest drops in violent crime anywhere in the United States of America. And we did it because we chose to work together. We did it because we chose to actually lean into this issue instead of leaning away from this issue. And while we know we're not done, we are incredibly encouraged by the fact that that Baltimore and the state of Maryland is just a different place when it comes to public safety since our administration has come on board.
You know, this debate on crime too often veers into ideology, defund the police versus lock them up. And I guess what you're saying, you mentioned several specifics, those are not the alternatives. And it's working together, communities, police forces, citizens. I don't know if focused deterrence is one, but tell us what you think are the major elements in this success.
Yeah, you know, I feel like sometimes society gets into these debates because they don't care about the final result, because they don't care about the people. And so they'll get into these extremes and they'll get into these camps knowing that neither is actually going to solve the problem that people are facing in their lives every single day, which is, can I feel safe when I walk around my neighborhoods? And I knew there were two dynamics that I wanted to address when I became the governor. One was the abhorrent violence and the fact that we are watching this violence that continued to spiral out of control, and also addressing the fact that somehow people thought that the only way to address violence is just lock up as many young Black men as you can. And in the state of Maryland, we saw how during my predecessor that the incarceration rate particularly for young Black men skyrocketed. And in fact, Maryland locked up more Black men between the ages of 18 and 25 than anywhere in the country. Number two, by the way, was Mississippi. And so I said, we can actually address those two things. That we can actually focus on reentry, that we sign the largest mass pardon in the history of the United States of America for misdemeanor cannabis convictions. And we have cut the homicide rate and violent crime rate by over 60%. So we show that this idea that the way you make community safe is just by locking up more people, we show that's not true. that the thing that you can do, you can actually support community and make sure you're serious about investing in local law enforcement, serious about investing in technology, serious about making sure that people are accountable when they are the ones who are terrorizing their neighbors and terrorizing our communities. And you can do both of those two things and address those dynamics at the same time.
This administration, Governor, blames a lot of the crime disproportionately on undocumented migrants. What's the case in Maryland?
Once again, it's just scapegoating and gaslighting that we're seeing, because, you know, when you're looking at what our immigrant community, largely documented immigrant community, is bringing and the vibrancy that they are bringing to our neighborhoods, it is overwhelming. That when you're talking about many people who are immigrants to the to the United States and who are living in Maryland, these are the people who are our chicken farmers. And these are the people who are our construction workers. And these are the people who are actually out there, not only working and supporting their families, but also then turning around and paying taxes. And so I dig into the stats on public safety deeply. Every single week, we are receiving our briefings. Every single week, we are working with our local jurisdictions. And I can tell you right now, I have not spoken with a single mayor or a single county executive who is going to tell me the overwhelming threat that they are facing is from undocumented workers. We are very, very serious about this issue. And this is something that's very personal for me, because I was raised by an immigrant single mom. And I know that we have a broken immigration system. I know that we've got to make sure we're getting violent offenders off of our streets, regardless of their country of origin. But I also know that that the gaslighting that we continue to get from the administration is both inaccurate and not helpful.
Well, I think most people agree violent criminals need to be sent back somewhere. But you have people like Tom Homan, who are ruthlessly rounding up, but going to, you know, Home Depot parking lots, finding any place where there's a large Latino community. And most of the people that they are apprehending, one man the other day, terrible, the father of three Marines in Los Angeles. This is really an indiscriminate effort on the part of Homan and company, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a completely indiscriminate, and it's not just many ways heartless. It's just arbitrary and foolish. I mean, you know, when you turn around and say, "Well, we're going after gang members, right? We're going after violent offenders," and then you say, "And we want to have 3,000 deportations every single day." I can tell you right now, there's not a single governor in the country who is being honest, who will tell you that by having 3,000 people deported every single day, that you're talking about gang members. You're not. That's not who he's talking about. And so you see how the narrative and the rhetoric and just the numbers that he's talking about are not adding up. So when you're talking about 3,000 people every single day that they are trying to deport, you know, you're going after, for example, the person over in the Eastern Shore, who is the migrant from Haiti, who is a chicken farmer. Well, I was talking, in fact, one of our businesses who told me that person has not now shown up for work because they're afraid of ICE raids. Or the person who we've had over, who was an undocumented immigrant from Ecuador, who has been in this country for over 20 years. Who is a single father of a child with special needs who was just detained by ICE, now essentially making his son, his child, an orphan that now the state is taking care of. So these are the type of things that this administration is pushing, and they're doing, if they're doing it under the guise of we're just trying to protect people from gang members. Again, it is not in any way, shape, or form accurate.
James. Yeah, so Governor, just a preface here, and I want to get right into this. I blame a lot on Democratic consultants, and I blame a lot on commentators, because people would say, "You don't even talk about crime. That's not our issue. Let's pivot to Social Security and Medicare." No, goddamn it, crime is our issue, and we're much better on it. If you look at what Bill Clinton and Joe Biden accomplished with the crime bill, with the unanimous support of the Black Caucus in the United States Congress, then somehow or another we figured, well, we got to run away from that, which is idiotic.
Yes.
Blacks should run cities, can't fight crime. Wow, you mean they can't? The murder rate in Los Angeles is like at a 60-year low. the murder rate in New Orleans is at a 50-year low. The murder rate in Baltimore is like dropping like, but we got to stop saying we can't do this because it's bullshit. We can do it a lot better than they can. That's my general view.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's funny, when I ran for governor, there were people who were saying like, well, don't touch the issue of violence because that's the third rail. Don't touch that one. Talk about the other stuff. But the problem is you do not want to own the issue of violence. And I was like, well, damn it, I am going to own it because this is a core reason why I decided to run in the first place. That I moved here. I'm now living in Annapolis because I'm living in the governor's mansion, but I moved here from Baltimore. That this is a very personal issue for me.
Right.
And there was no way that I was going to sit there for 8 years in a governor's mansion and give thoughts and prayers while we continue to watch bloodshed in neighborhoods and amongst my neighbors who I know. And so I could not agree with you more that there are people who would sit there and say, well, don't touch this and don't touch that and all this kind of stuff. And the answer is, then why are we even doing this in the first place? Why are we choosing to run? If you are not going to find, if you are not going to actually bring a measure of creativity and thoughtfulness and a different type of approach to problems that feel like they are intractable, particularly for the people that are living in the neighborhoods, then stay on the sidelines. Right. You shouldn't be running in the first place. And I could not agree with you more. This idea that somehow we should be dictated to about the things that we go after, the talking points that we use. And you all know, I was not the choice of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party wanted a different person who was running for governor of Maryland. And so I am now not going to turn around and ask for their talking points. There has to be a way to be able to think differently about these issues and produce the kind of results that we are seeing in places and that we're seeing in Maryland, where we're watching some of the fastest drops in violent crime anywhere in America in the state of Maryland. And we are proud of that, and we're going to continue leaning into it.
So Governor, you said the magic two words, and people don't want to talk about it, but you said it, and it's true. Predictive analytics is absolutely essential to this. Just explain in your own words what generally predictive analytics is and why has it proven to be so successful where it's been employed?
Well, because we now have more data than ever before, right? We have data and we're talking about technologies and cameras and all this kind of stuff. And we also know that a lot of the violence is predictive because when I say it's predictive, basically a lot of the violence is retaliatory. So for example, if James, if you take out Al, right?
Right.
I can predict who the next three victims of homicides are going to be because Al's people are coming after you and your people.
Correct.
It's just retaliatory. And then oftentimes what you see is with that retaliatory violence, you then have people who end up becoming consequences of that retaliatory violence. And so you can actually use predictive analytics. You can use technologies. You can use people on the ground like community violence interrupters, the people who are closest to the people in the community, and say the most important thing you can do when there is an issue of violence is that you have to simmer the violence for 48 hours. Make sure that the retaliation does not happen. Make sure that you actually then can infuse police forces and infuse other type of techniques to be able to make sure there's intelligence sharing, there's intelligence collection, that jurisdictions are working together. One of the most unique tools that I have as the governor of Maryland is something called MCAC, the Maryland Coordination and Analysis Center. We made historic investments in MCAC and made sure every jurisdiction was both providing inputs into MCAC and communicating. So we could actually stop things before they even happen because so much of it is just simple human behavior. And but if we're not using the technologies and if we're not sharing technologies and if we're not communicating, then simply you're always on the back foot and on the back heel of the stuff.
So Johnny shoots Joe. Predictive analytics is going to tell us Jimmy's going to shoot Johnny. So let's intervene to say it right there. We have the ability to know that.
Yep. It is human behavior. And it is utilization of technology to understand human behavior and making sure that you're intervening before human behavior behaves. It's not that complicated.
Absolutely. So I'm going to talk to you about education a little bit here. In Maryland is famous for Johns Hopkins, which is a world-class university. Medical Center at the University of Maryland is clearly one of the better state universities in the United States, but maybe my favorite is one that doesn't, not many people heard of, is called the University of Maryland, Baltimore City, I think it is.
Baltimore County.
Baltimore County. I'm sorry. I
didn't, UMBC.
Share with us the successes and why I'm correct in saying I'm a big fan of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I'm sorry I got the name.
No, it is all good. And you're right, because it's funny. The University of Maryland, Baltimore County, or UMBC, was really kind of a sleepy community university. And then a real legend in Maryland, a gentleman named Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, became the president and helped to lead this complete resurgence of what we saw from UMBC, of turning it into just a science and technology hub, where you are having not just some of the brightest technologists and engineering minds, but importantly, some of the brightest Black engineering and technology minds that you were seeing throughout the entire country that UMBC was the one who was developing. And so we saw how UMBC, you know, a lot of people got to know it when, you know, for all of our college basketball fans, when UMBC, who was number 16, knocked off Virginia, who was number one, and it was one of the biggest upsets in college basketball history. But a lot of people, while they first might have learned about UMBC because of that, you know, NCAA basketball upset, what in Maryland we knew and the world over knew was that the brilliant engineers and scientists and mathematicians, and oftentimes Black scientists, engineers, and mathematicians that UMBC was creating. And it just goes to show how our institutions of higher education have really been helping to lead the charge in terms of creating new type of opportunities, economic growth, and sustainable economic growth for individuals and families. But it does become interesting and deeply painful, the fact that this has also been an attraction point for people around the globe who want to come to UMBC or Johns Hopkins or the University of Maryland, College Park, or the Naval Academy, or all these fantastic four-year institutions, Morgan State, Coppin, Bowie. And some of the first things that this administration goes after are our institutions of higher education and our research institutions. That their definition of making America great is going after the things that makes America great. Going after the things that makes America such a magnet for talent. And so I'm really thankful for the leadership now of Dr. Shears Ashby, who's the new president of UMBC, and she is phenomenal. She actually came from Duke, and the leadership that came before her with Dr. Hrabowski. But this is really one of the crown jewels that we have, not just in the state of Maryland, but one of the crown jewels I think we have across the United States.
Well, we'll turn it back out and make this statement. The two greatest myths that exist are Black mayors can't fight crime or Black students can't do STEM. It's total bullshit, and anybody that goes along with that is contributing to total bullshit.
Governor, I know you have to go. I want to ask just one final question, though. They just passed a huge bill, the big, beautiful bill, they call it, which, among other things, cuts, I don't know, close to $1 trillion from Medicaid. But the sponsors say, hey, it's not going to hurt anyone. This is all about work requirements and getting rid of fraud. In Maryland, what impact will this Medicaid cut have on people?
I mean, this is the worst bill that's ever been passed against working families in our country's history. I mean, it's actually staggering, the impacts that this bill is going to have, because, and you know, it really is, and the way I've kind of called it, it's the Greed Act of 2025, because this is all about greed. It's the largest upward consolidation of wealth that we have seen in global history. It is making sure that we are then offering millionaires tax cuts, so we can, in the state of Maryland alone, you're going to cut about $250 million from our rural healthcare industry. Rural hospitals will close because of this bill, that we are seeing how about 250,000 Marylanders are about to lose their healthcare. That we're seeing how food programs and food assistance programs are going to get shut down. There are over 360 food banks that people rely on so they do not go hungry, that are about to lose their funding because of this bill. We see risk sharing agreements with our HBCUs, our historically Black colleges and universities, which are doing a remarkable job making sure they're creating pathways of higher education for so many of our people, that because of this risk sharing, about 75% of all HBCUs are now going to be put in a negative financial situation because of it. This bill is cruel. that we're watching about 48% of Black children who now will no longer qualify for the child tax credit because of the adjustments. So this GREED Act of 2025, what they passed is a very clear understanding for something that we have now known for the past 7 months, that it's not that the relationship between the federal government and our states has been altered. It's the relationship between the federal government and our states has been severed. And this bill represents also that it's the relationship between the federal government and its people, where if you are a multimillionaire, congratulations, this bill was absolutely for you.
Boy.
And if you were everyone else, you just got hosed.
We would love to keep talking about this, but your staff is telling us, give us the hook. You've got another meeting, but you got to come back sometime. But thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation, Governor. Appreciate
absolutely.
It.
I would love it.
Bust those miss, Governor. Bust those miss. Thank you. First of all, this stuff is stylish and is anything else. It's affordable. And when you look at what you get and what you pay for it, I mean, when you look at what the quality of what they do and the price they get, it's really remarkable. And just, you know, this is like high quality clothing at a pittance.
Well, we're a little too old to be chasing trends. Some even say at our age, we're setting them. But we're big on clothes that feel good with quality that lasts. That's why we keep going back to Quince. Once you try them, we know you will too. You'll love how quickly their lightweight layers and high-quality staples become your everyday essentials. You'll learn that quickly. Quince has the kind of stuff you'll actually wear on repeat, like breathable flow-knit polos, crisp cotton shirts, and comfortable lightweight pants that miraculously work for both weekend hangs and dressed-up dinners. The best part is that everything from Quince is half the cost of similar brands. That's thanks to their direct collaboration with top artisans, which allows them to cut out the middleman. That means Quince can deliver luxury pieces without the markups while still only working with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices on their premium fabrics and finishes. As soon as we saw their stuff, you're going to be just blown away, and it gets even better. The second you try your new clothes on, you'll see the fits are perfect. The fabrics are incredible and the style is unmatched. Everyone needs Quince's extra fine Australian merino polo. There's nothing better for looking your best in the summer heat, and there's much more. James and I have been looking for some new activewear for our summer adventures. At our age, we're sometimes not quite sure what activewear is, but we're looking for it, and Quince has us covered. As good as James looks in his new gear, my Quince favorite is their luxurious stretch wool dress pant. They feel amazing, and they're perfect for looking good, getting things done on the hill, or just reading in a recliner. So stick to the staples that last with elevated essentials from Quince. Go to quince.com/war room for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/war room to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/war room. The link is in our show notes.
Upgrade your style with Quince.
James, this week, Donald Trump posted a video of a bikini-clad young girl holding a snake. He accused Barack Obama of treason. He demanded the Washington Commanders change their names or else, whatever that is. Now, there's a couple things. I think he's slipping cognitively, as 79-year-old men are wont to do. We are experts. We're not president. Two reasons, although also come to mind. He wants to detract attention from this big, beautiful tax and Medicaid cut bill about which Republicans are going to get an earful over the congressional recess, and he wants to attract attention from his much closer than admitted ties to the late Jeffrey Epstein, the disgraced predator. More stories on them together have come out, And Epstein was a guest at Trump's 1993 wedding. I don't know if any criminal acts were committed. I don't have any idea what's in those files. But it's clear Trump is lying about their association. There is some sort of a cover-up going on. But in my full conspiracy attire, I smell a deal. Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general, says he plans to interview Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's confidant and co-conspirator, who is in prison. Now, Blanche is Trump's former attorney, a total loyalist. His only qualifications for his top Justice Department job. Maxwell was convicted of a federal crime, which means she could be pardoned by Donald Trump. If the caged bird sings the right tune, she could fly free. James, I apologize for my cynicism, but I believe it.
Well, also, don't forget that Alan Dershowitz is going to quarterback this. If I had to guess, there's remuneration involved. That's my guess. In reference to Trump, the problem is he so crazy, it's really hard to quantify. Is he crazier now than before? I'm starting to lean more and more. Yes, actually, Charlemagne the God, who's a very popular black podcast or broadcast, I don't know exactly what he has, but did a good job of chronicling his kind of lapses. And I think it's legitimate to ask journalists who were slow in the uptake about Biden's cognitive decline. Of course, everybody is appropriately piling on now, and they should, because it was something to see. But I think we need to see this covered more and more, his sort of cognitive issues, the crazies. Is he putting out more crazy crap now than normal? I suspect that it is, but I don't know how to measure it. Maybe Nate Silver, Harry Eaton or somebody can do that. I have no idea.
Well, I think some kind of trained neurologist who will tell you, I've talked to some, that, his bravado, his bluster, his bluffing, his noisiness, his loudness, that may well camouflage some of the things that we saw in Biden. That doesn't suggest that you're sharp or you're cognitively as strong as you ever were. It just means you can engage in a lot of bluster and bravado. So when you tell people, maybe he's slipping, they'll say, oh, no, did you watch him the other night? He was all fired, just all fired up. Well, that doesn't tell you anything, James.
First of all, neurologists are very reluctant to comment on, the Goldwater Rule.
Yeah.
They tell you it's hard to get him to go public. And it's because he's so goddamn crazy. You don't know if it's a neurological deterioration, because he says and does so many crazy things. But it does appear to me that he's getting crazier and crazier. And the Epstein thing is driving him nuts. You can see just trying to tell people to make it go away. Calling people, he's scared. Yeah, I think we can draw that conclusion pretty conclusively.
I do. No question, and your point's well taken on a neurologist or another doctor. But I think if you could find somebody who's an expert, maybe retired, I don't know what, and just look at speech patterns of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Stat did that some few years ago, and that can be very telling. Because there's something happening, but you're right. He's so crazy.
Usually when you start to deteriorate, it's not linear. It can go pretty quickly, I don't know. But he's the stuff that they're saying is just like insane. And he wanted to play golf with Obama, and now why would you? I mean, it's all if you just do the history of it. It's all just loony in the tin.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to turn to a couple other topics, James. Michael Luttig, the distinguished conservative former federal judge who's anti-Trump for a simple reason. Judge Luttig believes in the rule of law. Trump doesn't. In a new Substack post, he writes, "Never has the country's future depended more on a free press." But he worries that some of those upon whom this right has been conferred are surrendering it to a president who believes the press and the First Amendment are there only for one purpose, to serve him. Judge Luttig is talking about you, Disney and ABC, and you, CBS and Skydance, and you, Jeff Bezos, all of whom capitulated to Trump's indefensible demands to the detriment of their viewers, readers, and citizens. So, but at the same time, I want to applaud the Wall Street Journal for standing up to Trump's latest outrage, a $10 billion suit for a story the paper published on Trump and Epstein. Of two things I am willing to take to the bank, this story is basically accurate. They would have checked that 17 times over. And there's no grounds for a defamation suit. This is about the First Amendment. Secondly, Trump doesn't want to go into any discovery. This is just another bluff, another taco, as they call it on Wall Street, his latest. He'll drop this suit at some time.
Well, I think what's going to happen is anything happened with the Woodward suit. I think a judge is going to drop it for him. But, you single out the press and they bury deserving of it in many ways. And of course, most of this is a function of corporate ownership in the case of Disney, in the case of CBS, all across the board. You're right. The Wall Street Journal has sort of stood up, surprisingly. We were never fans of Murdoch, and we've traditionally been big fans of CBS. But I will say this. I think the Colbert thing was just losing money. I think it was unfortunate timing. But I think that late night TV is just not a very profitable model anymore. But, I'm going to be suspicious. But, it's not just big media companies, man. It's big academia, prestigious academia, Kevin. It's top law firms, it's companies, it's all kinds of stuff. I mean, the U.S. Olympic Committee, the Coca-Cola Company, all right? Look at all of the, I would call it capitulation, maybe business decisions, but this is a time of extreme cowardice all across the United States. It just is. And I just think that what these people are doing is going to historically harm their reputations, going to harm their place in history. And I don't know if they realize that everybody is into short-term survival. In one sense, I can't blame them. In another sense, the more that he succeeds, the more encouraged he is to go home. And why wouldn't he? He's going after the Washington football team, the Commanders. I mean, you would have thought all that was behind you. But it's not. But it's not that he's crazy, but it's the people, it's the accomplices that go along with this for short-term gain. They're going to experience long-term pain. I promise you, that's going to be a reckoning. I'm 100% convinced of that.
There's a very good piece that's just coming out in the Times about from the former U.S. ambassador to Hungary, who said the pattern over there wasn't just that Orban was bad and an autocrat. It was the business leaders, the academics, even some of the media. They just, they said, well, we can make nice with him. We can, cut a deal. We can capitulate. And guess what? Every time they did it, it got more authoritarian and more authoritarian. And he is basically looking at what's happening here and says it's deja vu. And I do fault them. I think the bottom line matters, but I think it's more about staying rich rather than sacrificing people.
If you think back, people would stand up for the country. They would risk things. People would risk reputations during the Red Scare, during the Vietnam War, during the Civil Rights Movement. They were courageous people. There were a lot of go along to get along people, but admittedly. But some people were enormously courageous. I think history has regarded them well. You know, got civil rights, gay rights, all kinds of things. And boy, courage in corporate America is really not very, it's not very impressive. I got to say that. Nor is it in, you know, across the board. It's not a, and this is just a dangerous time, man. It, you know, the more I think about it, the worse it is, the more inadequate it makes me feel. And he's, every time you do this, not just that he did it and he made you cave, it's empowering him and encouraging him to do even more.
Well, and it's also the effect it has on others. There are, I know, law firms, there are universities, there are even some media places that are kind of pulling their punches. They don't want to be a target next time. He has injected an element of fear. And, you know, that's really bad for a democratic society. It really is.
We cannot minimize what's going on today everywhere. And what this is like, and of course, you know, when you read our friend Ann Applebaum, a guy like Tim Snyder, I mean, these are people that are experts on totalitarian authoritative states, and they're just giving you the outline, and he's just following it. But I tell you, when we did our survey of the most odious Trump people, I think we missed the number one guy. I think when the history is written, Russell Voigt. I think when the history of this is written, I think Russell Voigt will be shown to have the most insidious influence of anybody. And I think it, all of these things that you're seeing, destruction of State Department, any kind of environmental info, any of this, I think originates with him. I really do. I mean, I think we had a good survey, and I think people answered it, and it was good, but I think when the history of this is written, and it will be, I think he's going to be character number one.
Boy, he's got tough competition with Stephen Miller, but he certainly is up there. I think he finished eighth in our
Miller
poll.
Does.
And that certainly was underestimating him.
Odious things. There's no doubt about that. And the stuff he's done with these immigrants is just simple. But Voigt is going about this methodically. He knew what he was doing. He came in knowing exactly what he was going to do. And then you look at, they're just going through the State Department, just firing people left and right with not any thought of anything. And I think we got distracted by Elon Musk. Doge was such a good story. Headspace was such a good story. Pam Bondi, such a good story. You know, obviously Stephen Miller. But I think at the end of the day, the real focal point, the real PowerPoint here, the guy that's caused the most destruction is Russell Voigt.
And he's able to do it because of the Republican Quislings in the House and Senate who are going along with everything.
And then they go and they say it's bad, but they didn't have anything. The Amy Klobuchar piece about how it actually rewards fraud was like one of my hat's off to her. That was a really well done piece. And you read it and you said, this can't be true, but you know it is.
Well, Josh Hawley cast, you know, key vote for cutting Medicaid. And before the ink is dried on Trump signing that, he proposes some to restore all those cuts. Where were you when we needed you, Josh? You know where you were? It's the same thing you did on January 6th. You were ducking. You were evading. You were a coward.
And that guy, he has all where he grew up, and as I recall, I just love to compare him and Bill Bradley, because I think Bill Bradley is one of the most noble Americans in the whole entire post-World War II era. They both grew up in Missouri. They were both sons of, I think, affluent bankers, all right? And look at the career, and they both went to elite schools. They both have all-world intellects. And look at Bill Bradley's career, which is, in my view, one of the most distinguished careers that you could imagine, one of the best, most authentic, most humane, most curious people I know. And you just compare that to Josh Hawley, and I think that's the best way to understand the America we had and the America that we've become.
And as we found out at the 92nd Street Y last year, Bill Bradley continues to excel, absolutely, continues to impress, to contribute.
Every way that a human being can, being an active senator, you know, from being a Barwell athlete and scholar and being a vision on the whole issue of, you know, civil rights, and to even the show that he does today, which I find very good, where he goes out and talks to, you know, sort of extraordinary Americans that you never heard of. I just, the comparison to him and Josh Hawley is to me so one of the instructive ways to look at the country. If I had the know-how and the ability, I'd do a book on this. I think it's such a startling contrast.
Well, the show me state has shown it's a great contrast. James, I got one final note, and this is difficult for me, James. For all of your charm and talent, there is one Democrat who apparently does not like you in a profanity-laden tirade on podcast. Hunter Biden went after you, George Clooney, and any others who thwarted his father's reelection bid. I admit I'm a little hurt I wasn't important enough to make his F-bomb tirades, as I also was against Biden running. But I take great pride that my podcast partner made that list. What do you think, James?
You know, Al, first of all, the Carvilles are kind of an Irish clan. And of course, that whole thing is like part of Biden's family. And Hunter has had a say the least. I didn't take much offense at it. And the truth of the matter is, I never liked it. I did what I did because I thought I had to. I didn't think I had any other choice. Unlike, you know, just kicking the shit out of Ken Starr, which I enjoyed every day. I couldn't wait to get out of bed to do it. And I had to end up like being anti-Joe Biden. And boy, there are no people who are more disliked ethically, morally, or anything else than Ken Starr or Joe Biden. But I kind of, if it was my dad, I can't tell you I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, and I agree.
The pressure on him and is got to be enormous. So, I understand where you're coming from.
Well, I do too. He would better serve himself and his father, though. Just it to would've, you it know, stay in better, the background. But you know, it is what it is.
It's emotional. Yeah. You know, there's a lot tied into it, but it's a lot of the culture of there is that no one respects us, no one, which is not true. Okay, if you would have gotten out of the race in September of 2023, you'd
most
be
respected figure nothing. In the world.
Yeah, you'd be the most popular person in the world. You'd be like Grant. Yeah. You'd be going to visit Disney or something.
Right.
Okay?
Right. No. Anyway. Sorry, Hunter. I hope you get better.
I ain't mad at you, son. It's amazing. And what they can do is they can go to producers that you don't necessarily know, and they can find really high quality stuff, and they can get it at a good price. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. You know, because you hate going to the store and being paralyzed by options and prices. But now you can get exactly what you want and ditch that store for good, all thanks to Naked Wines. We love they're a sponsor of this podcast, and you will too. As soon as you show up to summer parties or a romantic dinner, remember those days, James, with a chilled bottle of an amazing vintage from a unique and storied independent winemaker from Naked Wines, you're going to be an instant hit. We could have used that 50 years ago, James. By now, you know, we love wine, and there's nothing better than a nice glass after a long day with friends or family. Naked Wines will have the perfect bottle for any moment at great prices. Again, this podcast is sponsored by Naked Wines. It's a wine club that directly connects you to the world's best independent winemakers so you can get world-class wine delivered straight to your door. Plus, you can use our code WARROOM for the code and password at nakedwines.com and get six bottles for just $39.99. You heard that right. That's less than $7 a bottle for quality wine. Plus, Naked Wine helps you take any meal to the next level with the perfect bottle for that occasion. Thanks to Naked Wines, you can share an amazing seafood feast paired with a 2024 Cuvado family, Alvarinho from Portugal. It'd be a dinner to remember. And the best part, every bottle is a passion project from an independent winemaker. So you are literally making their business dreams come true. So how do they do it? Naked Wine brings you amazing wine straight from the winery at up to 60% less than what you would pay in stores by cutting out extra costs like middlemen markups. Winemakers can pass those savings on to you without skimping on quality. Now's the time to join the Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/war room, click enter voucher, and put in our code war room for both the code and password for 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99 with shipping included. That's $100 off your first 6 bottles at nakedwines.com/war room when you use the code and password war room for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99. The link is in our show notes.
Start your summer part is right with Naked Wines.
And now for the outrage of the week. James, Pat Moynihan often said everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. Here are some unassailable facts. Number one, Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump in the 2020 election. The popular vote wasn't even that close. Every court case, recount, or Republican post-election inquest attest to that. Except Donald Trump's insecurity won't allow him to acknowledge that even though he came back and won last year, his only match against Joe Biden was a defeat. On January 6, 2001, this is second undeniable fact, a violent mob attacked the Capitol to overturn the election. Hundreds of perpetrators were given due process, a fair trial, and convicted of a crime. But Trump released all the criminals while pretending to be a champion of the police. The Capitol Police, who were mauled that day, saw 5 of their members die. The Russians interfered in the 2016 election with the intent of helping Donald Trump. That was the unanimous findings of the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Marco Rubio. Today, the disreputable disinformation guys, led by Tulsi Gabbard and John Ratcliffe, are trying to change that reality. They are either misled or dishonest about the big issue. These people really, I mean, they are small-minded and mean even on stuff that's not as important as that. Our guest last week, Shane Harris, wrote that a former CIA director, James Clapper, through a nonprofit, sponsored a training dog named Susan after his recently deceased wife. The dog was so good that it was accepted by the CIA. And they were going to have a big ceremony for the dogs that were going to become those intelligence training dogs. And the nonprofit invited Clapper, who had sponsored Susan, to the ceremony honoring these dogs. Trump, Ratcliffe, and company vetoed his presence. They are duplicitous, they are mean, they are incompetent, and they are really petty people.
Well, this, I guess an outrage observation. People way, way underestimate what the Democratic Party is, who makes it up, and what can do. And we have started to accept the election returns from 2024 as being indicative of shifts away, a shift to, and analysts. And I think it's all bullshit. I think the fear that the Democratic Party is going to go overboard left is unfounded, and it's dead-ass wrong. I just saw something today, and I want to share it with you. If you said, where's the center of progressive America, whatever the fuck they call themselves, you've got to kind of say San Francisco, right? I mean, that's where they wanted to take Abraham Lincoln's name off school. And they had a very progressive mayor. Her name was London Breed. She was model progressivism. In July, of 2024, she was in office. Her favorability was 28 favorable, 71 unfavorable. Then San Francisco elected a really rich Daniel Lurie. I think he's part of the Levi's fortune. White male. Oh, God. What are you going to do? Daniel Lurie's right now enjoys a 25% negative rating and a 73% positive. So we've gone from 71 negative to 73 positive in a year. Understand that. There is nothing to fear out there, people. There's nothing to fear. They're not going to overtake the party. This is, you know, and for God's sakes, let them run in the primaries in 2028. Don't worry about it. There's just way too much angst about, oh, if we do that, James, oh, they got all the energy, they got all the organization, they got all the money. Oh, bullshit. People want their cities to be governed, and people are doing it every day and doing it effectively. And if they're Democrats, and we can talk about this again and again and again, but there's a successful way to do things, and there's a goofy way to do things. And if in 1 year you had, like, I don't know, 100-point turnaround in unfavorable favorable, it's really stunning. And it happened in San Francisco. Understand that.
Just watch New Jersey and Virginia this November. You'll see where it is.
But did you see the story today in Johnson Martin and Politico? They're giving up in Virginia. That guy, you had a Republican governor, and
he
the party has given up.
He is going out of office. I mean, this was the great hope for so many Republicans. A respectable Trump, an oxymoron, and he was going to be fantastic. He'd beaten Terry McAuliffe. He's going out of office, having accomplished almost nothing, so unpopular that the Democrats are going to probably sweep, and Glenn Youngkin's political future is nowhere.
Oh, they're going to see her. But understand, you say, oh, James, don't say that. We're going to win because people are not going to be motivated. Yeah, you're motivated to vote. You know why? Because margin is everything. You send these sons of bitches a message, all of you in Virginia. I don't have to stimulate you or tell you to go out and vote. Not that it'd do any good. Anyway, you know what's at stake. You have one purpose here, and that is to send these assholes in the Trump administration a message, we're not happy with this at all, and I have every confidence you're going to do it. And now to switch into New Jersey, and just remember, the guy who is running now came within, I don't know, 2.5% in 2021. He ain't going to do that.
He's a Trumper.
Well.
He is a Trumper. And, you know, take Mikey Sherrill and give a bunch of points.
Yeah, I'm serious. And it's one thing to know you're going to get beat. It's another thing when you actually get beat. And I can't wait for all of these analysts that proclaiming the death of the Democratic Party, the shift away among this, like that's some kind of permanent condition. They're all going to be trying to rewrite this shit next, even November coming. And when they see what's going to happen in November 2026, they're going to rewrite that again. The problem with all of these analysts and these quants is they think one election is permanent. They don't understand that there's giant shifts. Just look at the giant shift that happened in San Francisco.
Well, they also don't want to recognize that maybe Joe Biden and Kamala Harris had something to do with that outcome. But
right.
And, you know, in any event.
It actually, candidates matter. I got news for you, quant. Candidate quality is more important than a regression analysis.
Okay. We will be back with more outrages next week. And now for our favorite section, questions from you all. James, this is a difficult one. Peg in Morgantown, West Virginia, home of the West Virginia Mountaineers, asks, what is the tackiest grift committed by the Trump crime family? She thinks it's the toy garbage truck, but I don't know. What kind? Do you have another candidate? There's so many tacky grifting things going on with them.
Well, you don't count Trump himself. Which is, you know, I don't know, grabbing him by the you know what, that's tacky. You walk up to a female and you grab their vagina, that's pretty tacky. I don't know if you'd call Kimberly Guilfoyle a member of the family, but she offered to do lap dances for donations. That's pretty tacky. Melania was a nude model. That's at least at one time that was considered kind of tacky. Jeffrey Epstein, I don't know, man. The tackiness just it's unending. I can't imagine a word that fits better. It was a great question from our friend in Morgantown, because these are some tacky ass people.
We're going to research this and we're going to get back to you, because it is a good question.
Yeah.
And they're putting out all kinds of, you know, products. Many of them as fake as Trump.
I think we're going to find more and more about Melania as this thing unfolds.
Okay.
That's my view.
Second question is from Eric in Lacey, Washington, who says Rubio should have the background to be an effective Secretary of State, yet he's gone full MAGA with everything he's done. Is that to enhance his chances to be a candidate in 2028? Yeah, that may be part of it, Eric. But let me tell you something about Trump. You know I have contempt for Trump. But he's like a dog. He can sniff weakness. Dogs can always sniff if another dog or a person is weak. And he knew that Marco was weak. He's seen it. Marco was the guy who was going to sponsor immigration reform until the going got tough and he got going. Marco was the guy who was going to come make a big deal in New Hampshire in 2016. So Chris Christie sliced and diced him and ended his campaign. So I think Trump knew exactly what he was getting, a totally acquiescent Secretary of State that matters much more than any background.
All right, so I'm going to be a little bit of a Sigmund Freud here, but I think what Trump really enjoys, I think he enjoys it to the extent that it's almost sexual, and that is just humiliating people. And he really enjoys just taking Marco and just slapping him around and watching how acquiescent he is. Now, you understand Marco headed the Senate Intelligence Committee in 2016, which concluded without even any controversy that Russia had interfered on behalf of Donald Trump. Right. I think there were 8 people on the committee. He was the chairman of it. And Trump is opposed to, like, just watch his... You know, sit down, Marco. You know, lick my feet, Marco. Do this, Marco. And he does it. And I think that Trump just has so much fun humiliating this little twerp that I think he derives some kind of a sexual pleasure at this. And I think Rubio, he might enjoy being that. I don't know. Maybe he likes being humiliated. I don't know. There's something weird here. It's not explained, and you have to go a little bit deeper.
I hope I haven't demeaned dogs by saying that Trump could smell weakness like a dog, but in any event, Shane in Minneapolis, Minnesota, asked you, James, is it time to stop playing safe and nice? Should politicians start saying Trump's voters and Republican voters are responsible for MAGA's actions and policies?
Well, you know, first of all, it's got my friend in Minneapolis. I was just there. They're a great town, a great coach there. It's really a remarkable place. You know, if we would have nominated anybody else, Trump wouldn't have won. All right, that doesn't excuse him for voting for Trump. And it doesn't excuse that lack of intellectual curiosity. I mean, if you look at them, they're more likely to believe the craziest shit that you can think of. But what's really troubling are there are actually some sane people that voted for Trump. And it's not going to do any good. You may feel it, and sometimes I do too, but it's not good. It never does much good to attack voters. It's much better to try to come at them a different way.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I understand where you're coming from.
Remember the deplorables. It just makes no sense. Bill in Cleveland, Ohio, ask, this is one for me, James, because as you know, this is where I'm going. What is the origin of the term D-Day? Bill, to show you how much we respect our listeners, I went to the best source on that subject, and that is the grandson of the Supreme Allied Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force on June 6, 1944. That would be David Eisenhower, the grandson of General Eisenhower. D-Day, D stands for launch. No one knows where the acronym came from. There's nothing more complicated than that. D-Day was the launch of the greatest amphibious mission, I guess, still in the history of the world. And one of my great regrets in life has been that I never have been to Normandy, and I've been talking about this with James. And next week or in 10 days, we'll be going there. And James, we have a great guide. And the reason I know it's a great guide, because when we were in your town in New Orleans, we went and had a wonderful tour of the World War II Museum. So we're on their mailing list, and they told us, and they, in the latest mailing, they said, when they take people to Normandy, this is the guide they use. So I think it's going to be fabulous. And I hope, you know, now, Bill, it just means the launch day.
Yeah. Thanks for the shout out. 'Cause that World War II Museum is, if you can afford it and you live in the United States, you should go. By the way, the best time to go to the World War II Museum is actually kind of right now. I know it's summer and you're as hot as hell. It's humid, but you know what? It's not going to be crowded. And trust me, it's all air conditioning. And when it comes to D-Day, one of my favorite characters in any movie was the guy. Remember D-Day? Mm-hmm. It's like hilarious. So, yes, and I'm so glad you're going. It's a great story. It's just a great story to meet also of logistics. I mean, you know, all the generals say amateurs do tactics, professionals do logistics. Let me tell you, Eisenhower could do logistics.
Man, they did, because they made a bunch of mistakes in the beginning, and they had backup plans, and they had tremendous soldiers, not the officers, who were able to adapt. At least that's what I've read. But I'll be by this time 2 weeks from now, James, I'll be one of the great experts in the world. Right. Anyway, right. I can't wait to go. Joshua in Lubbock, Texas, says, right. knowing that the House may flip and God willing the Senate, I can't imagine the Trump administration won't be interfering in every way imaginable and unimaginable. Are we ready for it?
So let's start with the question, because something to think about. In order to create five Republican districts, that thing is already gerrymandered, okay? Yeah. So if you gerrymandered more, you run the danger of you have to poach Republicans from another district. All right, I mean, it starts with herding all the Democrats in the same district. So if you look at the map of Louisiana too, you can see it. And that's all the Supreme Court. Okay, that's who. And so then they're going to open this up. Then the Democrats say, well, we'll do California, New York, or Illinois.
That's tough.
But they run a danger of doing it in this cycle, because if it comes a really good Democratic year, if you have a plus 12 Republican district and a plus two Republican districts, yet in order to make the plus two more, you have to poach from the plus 12. Am I making sense? Yeah, I think I am. And so, in an ordinary, predictable year, you could pick up a couple seats. But if it goes wrong on you, you're weakening Republican incumbents by poaching voters from them. And then when you get to Austin in the legislature, let me tell you, these Republican members of Congress, they don't have an overarching view. They want to run in as safe a district as they possibly can. I think this thing is fraught with danger for them. I don't think it's just as easy as it's just made out to be. The legislature can come in, they can redistrict, they can create another five Republican districts. It may be in a certain kind of year they can, but if 2026 is going the way it looks like it's going, they could screw this up pretty good.
I agree. Ed in El Sobrante, California. This is so good, Ed. This is so good. I was wondering if James would have been as successful if he'd been a Republican consultant. I want to tell you, Ed, his mama and daddy didn't create and raise that boy to be a Republican. He'd have been a total flop as a Republican, which is why he's so great as a Democratic consultant.
Yeah, I don't know. I could never imagine myself being a Republican. All I got a lot of friends. I don't want to think about it. I'm just like, I'm happy with who I am. I'm happy with the fact of my party ID. And I, more than everything, I'm happy with the fact that I think we're going to have a massive election in Virginia and New Jersey. And I think we're going to do very well in the midterms. And I'm very excited about the potential field we have for president. I think there are reasons, if you're a Democrat, to feel good about the party right now.
Right. There sure is. Tom in New Orleans, Louisiana, James, says, am I imagining this, or are Louisiana politicians more corrupt by like a factor of 10 than anywhere else? We relocated to New Orleans a few years ago, and I am continually amazed.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, there's a lot of corruption in Louisiana. There's corruption everywhere. You can be any more corrupt than what you see in Washington. They're pikers. We don't have that much, but we're corrupt, but there's not that much to steal here. Don't get me started on the stuff on the coast, anything like that. But the answer is I've lived all over the country, worked in a lot of different places. And yes, there are a lot of corrupt politicians in Louisiana, but unfortunately, as a state, we're not that wealthy. There's not as much to steal. And it's hardly indigenous to Louisiana. So, you got good choices coming up for mayor of New Orleans. You got some decent choices here. So, I don't know that we certainly have got a lot of room to improve, but the place is just as bad. And the corruption is more insidious in Washington anyway.
Okay, Tom, understand it's all relative. A good answer. All right, listen, we love those questions. If we didn't get to yours today, please send it to us back in next week. We'll try to get to it next week because your questions are as good as any I ever get. So I can't thank you enough. Keep them coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Quince and Naked Wines, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.